Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. This is episode 11, wrapping up our exploration of what I call ancient solar energy, coal, natural gas, and oil. Yes, you heard that right. This podcast has gone to 11. Most podcasts apparently last about 3 episodes, so I'm thrilled to be in double digits. It's also going both better and more slowly than I expected. Better in that I'm having a great time doing it and finding a diverse, enthusiastic, and global audience. Both the climate geeks and the climate curious. That's wonderfully humbling and gratifying. More slowly in that I'm averaging a little more than 2 weeks between episodes. You may have heard of the slow food movement. Call this the slow podcasting movement. So be it. It's a labor of love, but unless I hit the lottery or write a bestseller, pretty much subordinated to everything else that occupies my waking hours. I hope you'll bear with me. Needless to say, I'm thrilled that we are together in this journey of exploration during an unprecedented and pivotal time in human history. So, back to the business at hand. I finished the last episode by ever so cruelly planting one or two oil-related television theme songs in your head. The so very 1960s Beverly Hillbillies and the so very 1980s Dallas. But it's not just the Clampetts and the Ewings. Think of Upton Sinclair's Oil from the 1920s, James Dean in Giant, Syriana in 2005, and There Will Be Blood in 2007, Joe Nesbo's Chilling Occupied in 2015, even Moby Dick, really, seen through a petroleum lens. Oil, the liquid form of ancient solar energy, drives our economies and societies and populations, our transportation and trade, all manner of politics and war. A big part of our environment and climate, even culture, the stories we tell each other in books, television, and movies. Oil is directly or indirectly embedded in pretty much everything and everyone, everywhere in our world. To loosely quote one of my all-time favorite movies, which also happens to be oil-related, The Local Hero, can you imagine a world without oil? No automobiles, no heat, and nail polish, ink and nylon, detergents, and plexiglass. You wouldn't get any plexiglass. And without plexiglass, I'm compelled to note, no ice hockey as we know it today, which would make the world a much sadder place. Go Rangers. No plexiglass, and in many parts of the world, no reliable and affordable electric power, which is our focus for this episode. So, leaving aside a lot of oil-related topics for future episodes, let's drill down on oil and power generation and see what we discover. As always, eyes wide, wide, wide open. We begin, as always, at the very beginning. Set the Wayback Machine for 200 or so million years ago, and we step out into a now familiar scene. Plants and animals living and eating or photosynthesizing and then dying, their remains settling into the beds of shallow seas. Those remains, still holding some of the energy they consumed in life, to be compressed and transformed into the various forms of what we now know as fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, and oil. Like today's natural gas and coal, today's oil deposits are a function of where those plants and animals lived, how the Earth's layers layered, how land masses moved and collided, and how the seas opened and closed as the supercontinent Pangaea broke apart in geologic time. Like natural gas and coal, those oil deposits are where they are on today's version of planet Earth. Some easy to access, some difficult, and some impossible. By geologic chance, easy abundance in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, but relatively little in neighboring Oman. The massive Bakken field in North Dakota, but almost nothing in South Dakota next door. It's the same story offshore, geologic chance. And, like natural gas, fracking and horizontal drilling have revolutionized the industry, both in terms of oil production volumes, and thus a downward effect on prices and an upward effect on consumption, and where oil is accessible, and thus geopolitics. The United States is a stark example. Long an oil importer, the U.S. is suddenly a net oil exporter thanks to fracking and horizontal drilling. As someone old enough to remember waiting in those early 1970s oil crisis gasoline station queues, that's a startling development to say the least. And, like natural gas, that fracking and horizontal drilling brings with it both frightening environmental consequences and climate risks. I won't repeat them here, but let's not forget about them. Plus oil-specific environmental risks and actual catastrophes like Deepwater Horizon, Exxon Valdez, the BP Texas City refinery disaster, the hellscape of Kuwait's burning oil fields during the First Gulf War. These are inherent in every drop, liter, gallon, barrel, and tanker we consume. And of course, some of the governments and others for whom oil revenues and natural gas revenues are their very lifeblood for prosperity or for oppression and aggression. I won't belabor them here, but let's not forget about them. So, eyes wide, wide, wide open, let's make some electricity with oil. First, why use oil? It's another case, really, of green eggs and ham. In other words, flexibility, options, and opportunities. Like natural gas, once we can get oil to a power plant, we can convert it into electricity in all sorts of machines of all sorts of sizes to play all sorts of roles in the power system. But as a liquid, oil is far easier to transport. Natural gas is generally limited to pipelines, and if we take a whole lot of time and money, liquefy it and put it in LNG tanker ships. Oil, on the other hand, can go by pipeline or tanker, but also by barge or truck. That's both reliability and resilience. A lot more options during both day-to-day operations and in the event of a natural disaster, like a pipeline cracking earthquake. And oil can be stored in tanks in pretty large quantities, especially right where it's needed. Again, both reliability and resilience. Both very good things. And perhaps even more than natural gas, oil-fired power plants can be more easily located wherever they're needed. But again, more easily does not mean easily, but still a good thing. Second, what kind of oil? Black gold or Texas tea? Just kidding. In all seriousness, though, where a given barrel of oil comes from and what it is refined into makes a big difference in its environmental and climate impact. It's a commodity from a commercial perspective, and if that's the only perspective, it makes things pretty simple, especially after it's been refined into a standardized product. Once oil becomes, say, diesel fuel, it's simply diesel fuel, no matter whether the underlying oil came from the Texas Panhandle or the Saudi desert, or the Canadian tar sands, whether it was fracked or not fracked, or fracked responsibly or not fracked responsibly for that matter, whether it was repressive regime perpetuating or not, conflict perpetuating or not, habitat despoiling or not, moved across land in lower GHG pipelines or across oceans in tankers, themselves burning oil, halfway around the world or not. And like similarly commoditized natural gas, that's just a few of the questions that stare back at you from a seemingly standardized product. The same is true for every oil derivative, not just diesel, but gasoline, aviation fuel, heating oil, even lubricating oil and asphalt. It's a seductive simplicity, and from a purely commercial perspective, it works. But not from an environmental or climate perspective, far from it. Attention, advocates, entrepreneurs, and big oil companies alike. Decommoditization, the dolphin-safe tuna analogy, is a powerful idea. You might even be able to charge a premium for it and do well while doing, well, if not good, at least a little better. Now, with that necessary complexity in place, making electricity with it seems like the easy part. And it is, with the same Dr. Seussian green eggs and ham optionality of natural gas. Think back on the boilers and steam turbines we talked about with coal. Yep, albeit not very efficiently. Think about the combustion turbines and steam turbines we talked about with natural gas. We can do that too, a bit more efficiently. Even reciprocating engines, engines with pistons that go up and down, as opposed to the round and round of turbines. Think about a Dr. Seuss scale version of what is probably under the hood of your car, some as big as suburban garages with pistons the size of bar stools. Even in reciprocating engines, oil-fired power generation, especially in reciprocating engines, oil-fired power generation is wonderfully flexible, starting up, accelerating, and decelerating like a sports car. That makes it great for backup and emergency power, something that sits silently most of the time, but fires right up as soon as the storm hits and the lights go out. At the grid level, that also makes for great service as reserve generators, filling sudden gaps if, say, a big 24/7 natural gas-fired or coal-fired power plant unexpectedly trips offline. The same can be true with respect to integrating renewable energy, filling in sudden gaps as the wind dies at a wind farm or a bank of clouds cover a solar farm. And for what is called peaking power, which we'll talk about more when we look at the power grid itself. Basically, that last increment of power necessary to meet demand and keep the grid operating on the highest demand hours and days, such as during a heat wave. Oil can also serve as a backup fuel for turbines designed to run primarily on natural gas, should the natural gas system fail. During an earthquake, say, it takes a purpose-built dual fuel machine, but it's not uncommon. You're seeing a theme here. Not the most cost-effective, or the most efficient, or the cleanest, but more of an insurance policy for life's inevitable calamities. That theme holds up for most of the world, but not all. Sometimes oil is seen as the best choice. If you're located on top of an ocean of oil, for example, like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has three of the world's top five biggest oil-fired power plants, each plant with enough capacity to run the city of Los Angeles on most days. Saudi Arabia sees energy security in oil-fired power, even as it burns the very product whose export fuels its economy, let alone the local environmental and global climate impacts. But it's not just the oil rich. Japan, which has almost no native fossil fuels at all, no coal, no natural gas, no oil, has two of the top five biggest oil-fired power plants in the world, and four in the top 10. For its part, Japan sees energy security not in local oil like Saudi Arabia, but in its oil import and storage capabilities, combined with the diversity that oil-fired power generation adds to a big, albeit troubled, fleet of nuclear plants, LNG-fired natural gas plants, and increasing amounts of renewable. Despite the enormous cost of imported oil and the same environmental and climate impacts. So far, so interesting. But oil has long been a niche player in power generation in most markets. Why is that? In summary, in the five-way battle of economics, location, efficiency, climate and environmental impact, and power system benefits, oil rarely comes out on top. But oil, and all its compromises, is almost always part of the mix. Given those compromises, it would be great to see a world where oil stays in the ground, or even a world where oil plays a much smaller role in our lives, from transportation to electricity generation to industry. But I don't see that happening soon. In the meantime, though, I strongly suggest that the backstory of oil compels a much closer look. Decommoditizing the commodity, that dolphin-safe tuna concept, is just one possible lens. More broadly, we must recognize that energy's compromises are inherent in the commodity itself. Every chunk of coal, every molecule of natural gas, every drop of oil is a microcosm of its origins, its extraction and processing, its impact, and its journey to us. An entire world of climate impact and environmental impact, technology's blessing and curses, regimes and corporations in geopolitics, local economies and global economics, human opportunity and human rights in every chunk, molecule, and drop. Food for thought in an imperfect world. As we come to the end of this episode, I would like to do a quick book recommendation for those looking for a definitive history of oil. It's called The Prize by Daniel Yergin, subtitled The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. And it is an epic quest for all those things. You won't be surprised that many of the true stories in the book rival the fiction I mentioned at the top of the episode. Although, suspiciously, legendary oil men Jed Clampett, J.R. Ewing, and Felix Happer have been expunged from the historical narrative. The Prize is not the newest of the genre. It was first published in 1990, so the perspective might seem a little old school here in 2023, but it is a comprehensive and readable look at something that most of us take for granted, or at least took for granted, until you, dear listener, got climate curious and became an avid fan of Climate Changes Everything. I'll see you next time as we continue our journey through the fuels, technologies, applications, opportunities, and compromises of electric generation. We'll go about halfway to renewables in the next couple of episodes, leaving behind the traditional GHG-intensive fossil fuels and digging into still traditional, but much less GHG-intensive nuclear and hydroelectric power. Not zero GHG, and not compromise-free either, but you've probably guessed that already. Eyes wide, wide, wide open? Good. I'll see you then, and thanks for listening.